This is Linda Shepherd, October 4th, 1993. Lifting the Veil, the Feminine Face of Science.
She's going to speak about that, and she also has a nice stack of books over here by the same name, so I hope you'll take a look at them and maybe you'll buy a book. Dr. Shepherd has a doctorate in biochemistry, and she worked in the field of biotechnology for quite a while. But about 5 years ago, she left that work in the healthcare community to devote herself to her research concerning the feminine in science, and specifically the feeling function, which I find intriguing because science really gets a bad rap. It's sort of always labeled as one-sided in thinking, and she's going to talk about feeling, the evaluative function of the psyche in relationship to science. And so I'm intrigued myself tonight. She's a member of this community. If you've been around, you see her quite a bit, so she's one of us in a sense, and I'm very happy to present her tonight, Dr. Linda Jean Shepherd.
Thank you, Kimbra. I'm really pleased to be here tonight because this has been an important community in my life, and in fact, it's where I met my husband, who's here tonight. And so, since the theme of this autumn is creativity, I thought I'd start out from the point of view of talking about science as a way that we use our creativity, and then I'll be going into the role of the feeling function in science, and also talk about what happens when feeling is kept in the shadow of science. And then finally, I'll talk about some opportunities that we have towards wholeness in the lives of scientists and in science. So science has really been a creative endeavor of humanity for a long time. It started out back in, I guess you could call the Aristotelian natural philosophers were the first scientists. And science started out in that respect as a representation of the feeling function, or the thinking function, where most of science was more looking at things and thinking what could be and making logical deductions about what they thought things were, as opposed to the experimental part of science, which started around the 17th century and started with the Royal Society. And then over the past 300 years, science has really transformed how we live our lives and what tools that we have for our creativity. It's given us things like film and computers and word processors that are now commonly part of our repertoire of creativity. It's also created new ways of living in terms of giving us a lot of different materials to build from. It's resulted in us living in more closed environments and less connected with nature than we used to be. And in that respect, I think it's also given us a lot of hubris as to what we think that we can do with a planet. And that's one of the things that I'm concerned about with science and with the immense power that science has developed. It's also gotten to the point where science has led us to the point where we actually can create life and manipulate life in projects like the Human Genome Project, where we're talking about sequencing the human genome. And it raises questions about eugenics and what we're going to do with that information once we have it. And in the biotechnology area, there's a lot of cases where we have designer animals now that have in their genetic code human genes that then make proteins that are used in the healthcare business. So we really do have designer animals. And in the computer business, we're looking at virtual reality and how that's going to be used. So there's a lot of ways that science is being used creatively. And yet I think it's time that we start to look at what tools and resources we're using. And these are both psychological tools as well as technological tools. And if we look at science as having used mostly the thinking function and our senses to come up with this body of information. It really leaves out psychological tools like intuition and feeling. And I'll talk more about exactly what I mean by feeling in a little bit. So I think in science we've come to the point where it has such immense power that we really need to think about how we're using that power and how are we being responsible for these things that we're creating. And what do we value and what are the consequences of these creations? And another level of creativity in science is talking about how we define our reality. And science has really created the myths of our culture. And everywhere from the Big Bang to myths in the terms of misconceptions, where I came across some research that's been done on what's been looked at as the passive female. And females have been looked at as passive, even down to the cellular level, where the egg is looked at as being just passively sitting in the female reproductive system, waiting to be wooed or awakened by the kiss of the sperm, or the Prince Charming of the reproductive system. And now there's some research that's just come to light during the 1980s with electron micrographs that have shown finger-like projections coming up from the egg and snatching the sperm and pulling it in. And using the Sleeping Beauty analogy, it's like Sleeping Beauty's throwing back the covers and grabbing the prince and bringing him to bed with her. So it's also very interesting that these finger-like projections have been observed since 1895, but they've been ignored because they didn't fit into this passive female kind of way of looking at how life is organized. And one of the things I want to take a look at the end of the talk is 20 years from now, how will we look back and evaluate whether we've made progress in science? So given my background in science and my interest in Jungian psychology, one of the ways I've expressed my creativity has been in writing this book. And I've been interested in Jungian psychology since graduate school, so it's been 15, 20 years. And I've been in science for about 10 years in the academic area and then 10 years in the industrial area. So it feels like I've seen a lot of different parts of science. And the title of the talk has to do with the way the feminine has always been present in science, but it's been veiled or has been in the shadow. And I'm talking about the feminine as the principle of relatedness, and this comes from Jung's definition. And it's a principle that is available to us all. And the masculine, then, is the principle of logic and analysis. And again, it's a principle that's available to us all. But in our culture, they've been kind of divided up. And so one of my theses in the book is that in order to be complete individuals and whole individuals, and this is Jung's belief too, we need to have equally value both the masculine and feminine and develop them in ourselves and in our endeavors. And I think it's particularly critical right now because all of the really important questions in science and in our culture are requiring us to bring more of ourselves to the questions. One of the analogies I talk about in my book is science being at midlife. And I came to this at the point in my own life where I've been in midlife, and it's really a time when we start to evaluate what the meaning of our life is. And for me, it was the time when my mother died. And so I was thinking about my life and, you know, if I died tomorrow, what would I have accomplished? What do I want to do with my life? And it's also a time that we face death. And as a culture and on the this planet, we're at the point where we face the possibility, through the technology of science, of annihilating the planet. It's a real possibility. And so I think it brings to light what we need to think about in terms of what are our limits, to consciously take a look at the technology and see how we want to use it and what the limits of it are. I think a good example of that is what we can do with toxic waste, and particularly radioactive waste from the nuclear power plants and so forth. And I think there's a project right now to examine the possibility of burying this in Yucca Mountain, which is near Las Vegas. And in the project, what they're trying to do is figure out whether this particular land site is stable enough to last 10,000 years and not release the radioactivity. And I think one of our limits is that we've only been on this continent for the past 300 years, and how can we extrapolate what the human condition is going to be in terms of political systems for the next 10,000 years? So I think these are very real limits that we need to have the wisdom and maturity to start to deal with. And one of the tools for dealing with this is the feeling function, because the feeling function is what helps us evaluate. Now, in my scientific training, I really absorbed the worldview that characterizes science. And in fact, when I took a management course, I became very aware that I had lost even the vocabulary to describe feelings, and you know, all the subtle words that are available for different levels of feeling were just not very conscious with me. And in my scientific training, I accepted such things like emotions have no place in science and science is value-free. And I felt I would lose my credibility if I showed my feelings. And in fact, I saw another neuroscientist being just totally dismissed by a biochemist because he said that, well, she's not exactly dispassionate about her work. And I wondered if this was just my overreaction to this, but then I found in the journal Science Education, and this is back in 1938, so it's quite old, but it's also reflective of what's, I think, now less questioned in science. And it calls for science to, quote, deliberately renounce all emotion and desire, and under the heading of readiness to think coldly, it advocates that science be impersonal and disinterested in thinking, and be unemotional, dispassionate, and thoroughly self-controlled in thinking. And in a study of the Apollo moon scientists, these were geologists and geochemists who were studying the moon rocks, the leader of the study asked the scientists to evaluate different pairs of adjectives relating to the ideal scientist personality, things like aggressive and retiring. And they described the ideal scientist as aggressive, hard-driving, self-serving, power-oriented, authoritarian, skeptical, diligent, and precise. And this is coming from them. But when it came to the dimension of warm and cold, 31% of them refused to even answer the question, because they judged it as totally irrelevant to science. And they said things like, I couldn't give a damn about that. It's not interesting. This scale is totally irrelevant to science. And then a third person who was a little bit more reflective about it said, a scientist who is dispassionate and cold, allowing his whole life to be run this way, is going to lack the motivation to do science for the reason why science is done, for the benefit of the human race. I tend towards a warm scientist, if you can get such a person. He can run into problems if he's too warm. So it doesn't really come as a surprise to me that the feminists in science are really talking about, and what they call it is the chilly climate of science. And I think those words are very apt. And in interviewing people for the book, I talked to Eberhard Riedel, who's one of the members of the Young Society. And he's a theoretical physicist at the U. And his classes, when he teaches, He puts an equation on the board, and then he asks his class, "How does that make you feel?" And I asked him, "How do his students respond?" And he said, "They look puzzled." And that's exactly the reaction that I want. I want to shock them. They may not remember the equation, but they'll remember that something strange happened. I think it's also interesting that Gene Roddenberry, in his vision of science in the future, has really addressed this question of not having feeling in science ever since the first Star Trek series, where the science officer was a Vulcan, and Vulcans have no feeling. And in the new series, The Next Generation, the science officer is a robot, and again, no feeling. So there's constantly a discussion in the Star Trek episodes about trying the importance of feeling in science. So emotions and desires and passions and attachments have long been suspect in science, and partly for good reason, because emotions can blur the perceptions, and fear and hysteria can exaggerate facts out of proportion to the situation. But rather than simply disregard all feeling and all subjective responses, I think it's time that we explore how emotion and feeling can make positive contributions to science and can help balance out the one-sidedness of the science. And the ways I think that they can do this is, first of all, by drawing attention to values and ethics in science. And secondly, by using feeling to help evaluate relevance and establish priorities. Third, by motivating research by love of nature rather than desire for prediction and control. Fourth, by respecting nature rather than looking to nature as a commodity. And fifth, by considering the feelings of other people. Now, Jung's model of psychological types I found to be really helpful to looking at the types of people that have been drawn to science, and also the types of psychological qualities that are missing from science. And these are largely qualities that our culture has classified as feminine. And tests like the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator have, I think, been useful to help people find professions where they're comfortable, but they've also served those professions a disservice, because in so doing, it narrows continually the different kinds of people that are in a profession. And my belief is that all professions need all different kinds of people in order to be whole themselves. Now, thinking and feeling are ways of evaluating information. Thinking judges by using logical discrimination and impersonal choice, and it's governed primarily by abstract and depersonalized sets of rules. And in science, the thinking type is the theoretician who builds models and logical systems and plans and organizes and puts things into hierarchies and takes care of the problem-solving function. And the prevalence of the thinking function of science has really given rise to the norm of impartiality in science, that a scientist be concerned only with the production of new knowledge and not with how that knowledge is being used. And I talked to somebody who's on a review panel for reviewing grants, whether to review them as to whether they're good science or not, and as a result of that review, some grants get funded and others don't. And she said, the way people review these grants is not to look so much at whether the scientific idea is important as to look at as to whether the actual plan is realistic, whether it's clear that one thing leads to the next. The premise of the whole review process is that the most basic scientific research is inherently worth doing without prejudging its ultimate payoff. And that premise extends to the idea of what you get funded. And this worked pretty well in science as a review process at the beginning, when about 50% of the grants were getting funded, because at that point about 50% of them weren't very good science, and so it was easy to make a discrimination based on the feeling function or thinking function. But it's gotten to the point now where only about 15% of the grants are being funded. And now the review panels are being asked questions of value, questions of which research would be more important, what area should be we be looking at. And they're finding the whole process very uncomfortable. And they said it's really starting to be a very painful process. And I think one of the things that they're struggling with is, what are their values? And what do we want to value in science? The feeling function, as described by Jung, could have been translated into English as to be called the valuing function, because it talks about how we give something worth, and it bases judgments on the personal impact that something will have on the people involved, based on a finely honed sense of good and bad and right and wrong, and what's moral and immoral and ethical and not ethical, beautiful and ugly, and levels of importance and harmony. So it gives us fine discriminations and priorities and helps us evaluate the importance of a research project. It helps us weed out ideas, and it helps assess the ethics of a situation. And I started out talking about how my language of the feeling realm was limited in science. And I was reading an article by Carol Cohen, who is a psychologist who went to a University Center for Defense Technology. And she went there to study the way language was being used, and she wanted to be committed to staying aware of what the reality was behind the words that were being used and the technology that was being created. And she found that when she would ask questions of value or feeling to the professors there, that she was ignored if she didn't speak their language. And she described it as kind of a techno-speak. And then after about 3 months of being there, she developed the ability to speak this racy, snappy, sexy language, as she called it. But then she found it made her unable to ask questions of ethics or value. This techno-speak talked about mass murder and suffering as collateral damage from surgically clean strikes. And she herself was shocked then when she could go for days at a time without making that connection between the language and what was happening with these weapons. So I think it points to the importance of language and the importance of bringing the language of feeling and values back into science. Another example is the Manhattan Project, where the scientists in that project were so caught up with the exciting idea and doing science that was on the edge and caught up in this whole thing of knowledge for the sake of knowledge. And to them, the scientist's job was to find out how nature's laws operate, as well as to build the bomb. But Robert Oppenheimer said that, quote, "It's not the scientist's job to determine whether a hydrogen bomb should be used. This responsibility rests with the American people and their chosen representatives." But then after Hiroshima, he really struggled for the rest of his life to resolve the moral problems that had arisen for him as a result of this particular scientific discovery and scientific discovery in general. And at the end of his life, he said that he felt that physicists had sinned, that it wasn't so much that they had built the bomb, but they had so much fun in doing it, that they had the time of their lives doing it, and they never really considered what the consequences were going to be in the process of building it. And Einstein, whose equations were used at a very fundamental level in the area of atomic energy, and he also wrote a letter to Roosevelt suggesting that a bomb could be built, and if we didn't build it, the Germans would. And at the end of his life, he said that if he had his life to live over, he would have been a plumber because of how his knowledge had been used, how his beautiful equations had been used. And he felt that, scientists were like caged birds and encouraged to lay eggs and then had no influence over how those eggs were used. Today, I think scientists are starting to become more aware that every scientific problem has a moral component. And I remember Charlie Johnston from the Institute of Creative Development being here a couple years ago when I was in the audience, and he told a story about being a facilitator over at the University of Washington for the chemistry department one Saturday afternoon. And the task that they were trying to grapple with was how to bring more excitement into chemistry and how to motivate their students more. And in the process of this discussion, they came to the realization that they felt like they needed to grapple with the more significant questions in science, and that in order to do this, they needed to talk together more. And then the question was, well, what were they going to talk about? And they came to the point where they realized that they were feeling powerless. And Charlie Johnston said that, well, you're men, you're chemistry professors, you're not in the humanities, you're at the upper level of status in this country. If anybody should feel empowered, you should. And what would it take to feel empowered? And what they realized was that all of the questions that they were dealing with involved a moral or ethical component. You know, if you're going to design new materials, today we have to talk about and think about what's going to happen with those materials at the end of their lifetime. How is it going to interact with the planet? What kind of processes are going to be used to create these new materials? And so what they decided to do by the end of the day was to bring together people from the humanities and from philosophy and from anthropology, and to start opening up the conversation of science. And I think this is something that's really critical, that we need to, if we can't address these problems ourselves, we need to bring other people into the conversation. And I think it's time that science asked for some help in that. One area where I'm encouraged is with the Human Genome Project, because this is the project to sequence the human genome. And it's the first time that I'm aware of that the ethical questions are being looked at the same time that the science is going forward, and it's being funded by the same project. So and that's really been the result of the media and people questioning how this knowledge is going to be used, because it has implications as to if you have a gene for schizophrenia or for alcoholism, what does that mean to insurance companies? Are you uninsurable? Will anybody hire you? Who has access to this information? If somebody has one of these genes, do we abort the fetus? So it really brings up a whole mass of questions. And it also brings up the issue of eugenics. And then in another area, I talked to somebody at the University of Indiana named Marty Crouch. And she's a plant biologist. And about 5 years ago, she decided to withdraw from experimental science. And she did so publicly in an article in the Plant Cell, which is the magazine or the journal for cell physiologists. And she'd been very successful. She'd just gotten tenure. She'd been working on plant embryo and pollen development and had 22 papers in 10 years and over $1 million in grants. But after she got tenure, she decided to step back and think about what her work was being used for. And unlike the Manhattan Project, where talking about building bombs, you'd think that agriculture is a fairly innocuous type of research. But she, in stepping back and thinking about how it was being used in the larger picture, she discovered that instead of feeding the hungry, what her work was really supporting was agribusiness. and multiple multinational corporations that sold seeds, the machinery, the fertilizers, the herbicides, and the pesticides. And instead of helping poor farmers, it was causing a lot of poor farmers to either retreat to the cities or to try to eke out a living on marginal lands and slash rainforests and displace wildlife and indigenous cultures. So she decided that she could no longer go on with business as usual, and she had to start to try to bring her professional life in line with her personal values. The chairman of her department thought she was crazy, and he really reflects the traditional compartmentalized view in his comment, quote, "She decided to try to address an important problem, and a problem that our department has traditionally not tried to address. It's not supposed to address it. It's a biology department, not a sociology department. That's not what we're trained for." So although she left experimental science, she's maintained her position at the University of Indiana and continues to teach, and now she's working with economists and anthropologists and sociologists to analyze the effect of science and technology on society and educate people about rainforests and ecological issues. And she's been invited by graduate students across the country to come and talk to them about the responsibility of plant biologists. And in this, I think she really represents a wonderful example of relatedness and looking at things in the larger context and drawing together knowledge from diverse disciplines and bringing together both her professional and personal values. So I think, again, the feeling function can helped her to judge the value of her research and bring it to bear on the issues of larger issues of world hunger and the destruction of the rainforest. And while the thinking function and sensation can contribute more details and more theories to the way we look at the world, it's the feeling function that helps evaluate how that research is used and how it affects other people's lives. Now I want to talk a little bit about motivating research by love of nature rather than the desire for prediction and control. One evening over tea and cookies at a friend of mine's, three women cell biologists got together and we were talking about our work. And it was really an exciting evening because their language got very loving and rapturous and passionate when they started to talk about cells, because these are all cell biologists. And at the beginning, they sort of exchanged surreptitious glances and were embarrassed by this kind of rapture. And Sigrid Myrtle, who's a cancer researcher at Bristol-Myers Squibb, summed up their delight with, "When you look at the microscope, you see life. Things move beneath your eyes. You stain them and they fluoresce. Beautiful keratin fibers, or cancer cells with these beautiful arms and ruffles on the edges. They're pretty. There's an aesthetic involved." I also talked with somebody at the University of Washington who's doing work on slugs. And again, she gets just rapturous about slugs. And she said, "Most people think slugs, yuck. But I think that whenever you start to study an organism, you become overwhelmed by the beauty and complexity of it. And I'm always amazed and touched by the way these animals solve the tremendous problems that they have, which are always really basically the same as ours." And so I think if we did science more from the position of love, of the desire of the lover to know the beloved, that we would do it differently. We'd ask different questions that are more respecting of nature, questions that involve less destructive testing, less destructive examination of nature. And I think we'd also look more about how to be in harmony with nature rather than how to use nature and exploit nature. And there's even a word in Japanese about the way that you can feel with another organism. It's I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it all correctly, but it's Kyogen. And there are people that have, like Jane Goodall, spent 30 years studying chimpanzees, and she would know their families, and the chimp families know them intimately from birth to death and all the sexual encounters that they had. And it was a very personal relationship. And when she was first trying to publish, she had difficulty because she was talking about the chimpanzees with names and calling them he and she. And the journal editor wanted her to use numbers and call them it. And they had this altercation. And finally, she managed to get it published with the way she wanted to, but it's still a struggle in science to have any kind of relationships or subjectivity in the papers that are produced. Another area where feeling is important in science is in considering the feelings of other scientists or other people that you're working with. And this includes patients or clients or lay people that we're working with. And I came across an article in about the biosphere last week where it said that human dynamics emerged as their biggest challenge. And I think this is very, very important because a lot of science involves collaboration and cooperation between scientists, and it seems that science has such a bias for the competitive model that when cooperation is required, it's very difficult. And a lot of people that I talk to, particularly women scientists, find it very collaboration one of the things that they enjoy the most, and yet it's also the most challenging because when they collaborate, they're looked at as being hangers-on to the research project, specifically if they collaborate with men. So now I want to talk to you a little bit about what happens when feeling is kept in the shadow of science. I came across a critique of some research that was done during the 1950s and 1960s at McGill University and at the Allen Memorial Institute. And this research was funded by the CIA and the Canadian Defense Research Board and the Department of Health and Welfare. And it was about mind control experiments. And these experiments were done on volunteer students, and they were also done on patients, mostly, quote, neurotic women at the Allen Memorial Institute. These studies were studies on brainwashing, and they included a combination of sensory deprivation, electroshock, and what was called psychic driving. And psychic driving is a process where the patient makes, the psychiatrist has the patient make a tape with their own voice where a phrase is taken like, I'm so lonely, and that phrase is repeated over and over and over again. And the patient listens to this for 10 days, 16 hours a day. And as the project name is called Artichoke, and their goal was to reduce people to the vegetable level. And the experiments caused brain damage that drove some people to suicide and to madness. Over half the subjects hallucinated. Many became openly psychotic. One became epileptic. And many suffered amnesia for events for the first half of their life. And yet these studies continued over a decade. And I bring this up because it's not that these studies were done by crack researchers or quacks. It was conducted by Ewan Cameron, who was the founder of the Allen Memorial Institute. He was also the president of the Canadian Psychiatric Association, the American Psychiatric Association, and the World Psychiatric Association. And at his death in 1967, he was lauded by the Canadian Psychiatric Association Journal as, quote, a diligent seeker after knowledge who brought deeper understanding of the importance and significance of the emotional life of man. And what I think this tells us is that even the best of us can open ourselves to doing evil under the banner of things like national defense or trying to solve world hunger, or you know, we rationalize behavior by thinking things like we're not doing permanent harm, or these people are exaggerating, or the patients were already neurotic. It's for their own good, and I wouldn't hurt anybody. But when we become so possessed by these kinds of goals, we really, and it can just be the goal of knowledge for the sake of knowledge, and just with the idea that we can't possibly do any harm. But and this kind of focus gives tremendous energy to the project, because you're not conflicted by, no thought or energy is wasted on ethical conflict. And it's very easy to become swept away by this intellectual curiosity and supreme confidence in the power of thinking. And it's something that we're all open to, where we can step into the most horrible evil without even noticing what we're doing. So I think it's I bring it up as a caution, and also as what can happen when feeling remains in the shadow. Stops us from, and compels us to take a stand and say, no, this is wrong. So now I want to talk a little bit about the opportunities towards wholeness in the lives of scientists and for science. I think that the creativity in science can also bring cooperation and nurturing and receptivity to science, and especially if we have the goal of wholeness. I think it's time that we redefine progress in science and that we develop more products that of human creativity that sustain the planet rather than threaten it. And with the immense power of science, I believe we need to develop the maturity and wisdom required to handle that power. We need to bring all of ourselves to the critical questions of today and for what we create for tomorrow. Thank you.
Why don't we take about a 15?
Okay. Yes.
Thinking of the cartoon that Gary Larson does, the Far Side does, and shows the scientists of black work and have their equation of all numbers and x's and squares, and it's like step three, and then there are four curves, and step four, and the guy says they can be a little more precise than step three. Okay. Using that as kind of an image or jumping off point, can you talk a little bit about what you're thinking?
Okay, the question is about how intuition is relevant to science. And I think intuition was first given any kind of credibility in science was by Einstein. And according to Jung's psychological types, I think intuition is the third type, the third function in science, and feeling is the last to be developed. And even today, though, a lot of scientists are very reluctant to say that they use intuition. And they might admit on a one-to-one basis that they do, but that it's not really totally credible yet. But in fact, Jonas Salk keeps a pad of paper and pen by his bedside and wakes up at 3 a.m. and takes notes for about 2 hours. And he has like over 15,000 pages of dreams, transmissions, whatever you want to call what he's getting. And this has been very useful in his research, and it's been seminal in like the Salk vaccine and the Salk Institute, and what he wanted to do there was in his institute was create a vessel for scientific creativity. And then there's also a lot of cases where, for example, the structure of the benzene ring was seen in a dream. It was a problem in organic chemistry that had been puzzling scientists for a couple hundred years, and this guy Kekulé was dozing in front of the fire and fell asleep, and during this dream he saw snakes chasing each other, grabbing each other's tails, and saw the structure of the cyclic structure of benzene. And there's also another example of somebody who was developing a sewing machine, and he couldn't get how the needle was going to, where the thread should come through the needle. And he had this dream about some primitive warriors coming at him with spears, and the spear had this hole right at the edge, at the point of the needle. And it was, I don't remember the details of the dream right now, but it was through a dream that he solved this problem that had been plaguing his invention. So I think there's a lot of examples of dreams having impact on scientific discovery, but not everybody's willing to own up to it. And I think there's also this whole process about struggling with something and struggling with it for a long time, and then going and walking on the beach or taking a shower, and that's when the answer comes. And this intuitive process is something that we don't understand very well. I think that's what makes that lack of understanding is what makes scientists reluctant to own up to it. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Carl.
It seems that the continuation of looking into Hong Kong and that is going to be impossible.
Does it seem inevitable that biotechnology become more and more focused at the more reductionistic level, and that it affect?
Yeah, it seems to me that they're going to develop more and more ability to make better cows, better animals, better food, better medicine, better tomatoes, and that it really can't be stopped.
I think it's really time that we start to question what technology is doing. And we've been operating on what I call a technological imperative, that if a technology is possible, we go ahead and do it. And I don't think that we can afford to do that anymore. I think it's going to be up to all of us as citizens to start questioning what technology we use and what values that technology represents and what implications it has to the planet, because given the lifestyle of the United States, can we afford to have the whole world living as we do? I mean, will the planet support it? I think it's probably time that we start to question what's enough. And I don't know if it can be stopped, but I think it's something that we all need to start thinking about and beginning a conversation about, and that's the only way I know of to start that. Because I don't think it can continue. I think that if it keeps continuing in the direction it's going, I think the planet may
decided otherwise. Yes?
Yeah, as we were running the break, I think that's the argument between Oppenheimer and Kelly. Oppenheimer, after his experience, said, we need to think about going to this thing, after he witnesses tests and so forth. And then afterwards, actually, Robert Hiroshima, he really got buried into his own case and so forth. And Edward Teller eventually won out, and we're still on that course of development.
Yeah, I think we have a tendency to not address problems until they become a crisis. And I've seen this in companies that I've worked in and tried to raise issues before they became a crisis, but it seems like only a crisis gets people's attention. But I really don't think that we can afford to operate that way anymore. Funny. I'm not suggesting that we necessarily stop science. I'm suggesting that we re-examine the questions that we're asking and perhaps ask different questions. We might want to focus on things that are more directed towards healthcare and the environment as opposed to, like in 1991, we spent 52% of the federal budget for research and development on military and defense. 0.6% on the environment, 14% on healthcare. I'm suggesting that we rebalance these. That's why I don't think it's a question that can be answered by any one person, that we need to begin a conversation between all different parts of society as well as within science itself. Because it's a very complex question. Thank you. I think the Cartesians and the separation of science from religion was perhaps timely in its time, necessary in its time, because at that point religion was the answer to everything, and it wasn't allowed to be questioned. So there needed to be somewhat of a separation from that authoritarian view, but I think something was lost as well, that worldview of everything being connected, of there being a web of life and everything being related to each other.
Yeah. In my vocabulary, science has sort of a negative connotation, like business. But, you know, it's just whack and some bad word in business and science. And for myself, I will probably reclaim both of those things with science.
Yeah, and science does bring a lot of power and what they call rigor to the way we examine how we work with people and various therapies and what works and what doesn't. But I think science also needs to be expanded so that it brings in more of the subjective and gives credibility to that. I came across a fascinating study that was done on kittens that were raised in a totally horizontal environment so that all of their stimuli were horizontal. And when they grew up to be adult cats, they literally couldn't see vertical things. They'd bump into chair legs. And I think this is really interesting in terms of how subjective our world really is and how we learn to give meaning to what we see, what we hear, what we filter out and what we don't filter out. There's another study of where children in this particular culture could... The language of their culture involves a sound that we can't hear. And if a child in that culture learns that sound and learns the language, by the time they're 18 months old, then they can hear the sound. But if they don't, their neural connections shut down and they can't hear the sound. So it really intrigues me in terms of a lot of extrasensory perception and what's sometimes called pseudoscience. But I'm really intrigued by what things we're shutting down in our culture by not attending to them. Right. And a lot of people in science are reluctant to study these things because they're looked at as being disreputable. And yet, I'm really fascinated by them. And I think that, you know, given the study about the kittens and this particular language, it really indicates that we have potentials that we're not looking at. Does that make sense?
Yes.
I'm having trouble hearing you.
I did consulting work at Los Alamos National Laboratory in communication, and I think the situation that exists there, Los Alamos being up 7,000 or 8,000 feet in the hills, totally isolated, and it's a close constituency, close community. People I work with are 50% men in the town of Los Alamos, and adhere to this sort of teller mentality of scientists and stereotypes of scientists. But we're 30 miles away, we've got Santa Fe, which is at the other extreme, and a lot of the people commute in from Santa Fe, and I have these two groups, and they just cannot communicate. But my function there is to try and get them to communicate, because the Close Society of Los Alamos, the scientific community, wants nothing to do with anything out of Santa Fe. And Santa Fe wants very little to do with Los Alamos because of the radioactivity and so on. So what you say now, I come into contact in my work there, and I don't
see much of a resolution of it. But all I can do is work on a one-on-one basis and we get them to understand each other, because although the Department of Energy is saying that it also understands switch to peaceful use of atomic energy, in fact, I would say that that peaceful use is only about 9 or 10% of what's going on there. There's still manufacturing plutonium, and the security there has been increased. So I am somewhat discouraged, in my words, by trying to put things together and having them constantly torn apart. And I see that there is that brainwashing dimension that's been in the scientific community there. There is this absolute brainwashing where they can't even consider anything different from what they have done before. And I see it with the families. And I speak to the families and permeates the whole family structure, because they're going to look at the world.
Yeah, I think sometimes it takes personal experience in order to get to the point where you're open enough to be curious and to think, well, maybe this isn't all there is to life. So I guess in terms of like who will read my book, I think there's a lot of people within mainstream science that will not even pick it up or be interested. But on the other hand, there's, I think, a lot of people that are open enough that perhaps a little bit at a time things can change. I don't think it's going to be anything that's going to happen overnight. But I also feel an urgency about it, that I have a love of science, and yet there's this real concern with what we're doing with it. So I appreciate what you're doing between Santa Fe and Los Alamos. Yes?
I'm curious, so you mentioned how scientists are involved in the Manhattan Project and many other military programs. In fact, we're only doing their job, and they're passionate about their job, but they lost sight of the big picture of what they're actually creating. But isn't that more of a cultural thing that goes beyond just science? I'm an engineer. To me, I see science as one thing, and then application of the technology, how we disseminate it through our culture, as being another aspect. And depending on where we want to go with it, it could be either good or bad. In some cases, there's some things like nuclear power that wasn't well thought out. But there's so many things that do have the potential for good as well as for evil. But they go all the way through our culture. You mentioned about the person in Indiana working in developing seeds for agriculture. Isn't our culture is demand for those products fueling that whole thing, the whole process? At what point in our culture do we decide as a society that we can't pursue? Because I don't believe it's just the scientists. Scientists provide the means, but I think so much of our culture provides the demand. And what do you, how do you resolve that? Where do we start saying enough as a culture? We certainly can't understand what we can. And we can't predict what will be in the future. How do we direct that?
I agree with you totally. I think science is totally interwoven with the rest of the culture. And that a lot of the things I'm saying about science is true of our culture. And that because they are so interrelated, we really need to start these conversations everywhere. And the only thing we can really change is ourselves, first of all. And maybe that's my Jungian bias speaking, but in doing so, I think we can be more effective within the community than if we go out as not whole people first. But yes, I agree, it's all totally interwoven. It's all connected. Yes?
I wonder if part of that, too, would be drawing science and other disciplines together, like we were talking about the person who left the department of mental health, the Roman sociologist and anthropologist, and project potentially about the break. I wrote a short 25-paper at the end of the 25-page paper at the end of the master's degree in therapy, and I read a model of the physicist and philosopher about the ways that science and other disciplines, you know, like in the academic world, you were part of, or the industrial or commercial world, that science can not be acted out in ways that science can get pulled into dialogue with other disciplines might help them in this process of the way that intuition is feeling and receptivity.
Well, it's starting to happen a little bit with the Human Genome Project, where the way this funding is happening is that it's sponsoring projects to bring people together to put together papers about what the ethical questions are. And in order to do that, they're bringing together people from, well, first of all, clinicians with the researchers who are doing the sequencing, and they've never talked to each other before. So the sequencers have never realized that what's going to be the first thing that happens once a sequence is known and it's is that we're going to have to make decisions about aborting fetuses. And they hadn't thought about that consequence before. That, you know, it'd be nice to say that we'll be able to fix the genes in situ or in the fetus before it's born, but in reality, the cures are probably decades away, and so how are we going to handle things between now and then? So they're starting to bring together researchers and clinicians, but I would also like to see them bring in pregnant mothers, bring in people who have been disabled from birth to talk about what their stories are and what they feel their contribution to our culture is. I mean, do we really want everybody to be perfect? I mean, is physical perfection or intellectual perfection what we're after? You know, this whole eugenics question is you know, who makes those decisions? So it's starting to happen a little bit with Human Genome Project. And I'd like to see it happen more in educational institutions as well. You had a question? That's right. That's right. Yes.
It's kind of my thought on the amount of static liability and allergy issues would be an interesting deal. Could you just play with that idea of what, how would that affect science if they were, let's say, an outrageous proposal, but a certain segment of the population believes that the AIDS virus is a runaway virus from an experimental body someplace?
Or what if the people?
Rhesus monkeys and so forth, and got into blood donors. I mean, I've heard this. What if that actually was a scenario that was true, and what would be the implications of
Or what if the people of Hiroshima sued the American government?
Yeah. So they seem to be immune. Why are researchers, or, you know, at the professional level, immune from climate? I guess that's another point.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it. I guess I'm reluctant to take the approach of litigation, because I'd rather see us solve problems by working together and cooperating, because it seems like litigation drags things on and delays things longer than it takes to solve the problem. You know, if you look at what happened with the Exxon Valdez oil spill, it's been years in litigation, and more money has been spent on lawyers than it has been on solving, you know, finding out what damage is being caused by the cleanup procedures that's been worse than the damage caused by the oil spill. I talked to a couple of people that have been involved in that cleanup process, and one of the things they said is first there's the oil spill and then there's the lawyer spill. And so I guess I'd rather see us solve the problems than try to place blame.
How about the Greenpeace?
The what?
Greenpeace, where they run around their zodiac, you know, getting away of a large polluter or a ship at sea, and they get a lot of publicity. But somebody that might have an ethical, you know, feeling about something could confront them.
I think they've served a function, but I guess it's not my approach. It's like people trying to to stress more humanity towards animals by burning down the laboratories doesn't seem to me to be quite getting the point. It's more like taking on the methods of the one who's causing the violence. And it seems like it's equally polarized then. So I'm not really comfortable with that approach. David?
I think you remind me of something I hadn't thought of a long time, which is that a long time ago, in my undergraduate year, 1968, I took a class from, at that time, the head of the biology department at the University of California, where I was going. And it was called Biology and Public Policy. And what he did is he got people to take that class from all various disciplines in the university. There were artists, philosophers, art majors, philosophy majors, history majors, English majors, as well as biology majors and other science majors. And we basically spent an entire quarter discussing the things that were going on in biology and how they affected public policy and how they affected the environment. And this sounds like something that is along the lines of what you feel is necessary.
That sounds like a wonderful example, yeah.
I'm struck in my experience by how much those of us, like myself in humanities, learned about what was going on in the sciences as it was that we were giving our input into what we thought should be happening.
And I think if we have a mutual curiosity, it can go a long way. Because there's things to be learned on both sides. Yes?
Was there, I mentioned John Sanford's, and he's not the only guy that said that, but I think somebody came up and said, whatever happened to the concept of Sanford's was a manager clinic. Got found that as a manager. Brought that up. He's in the world of science, but you were talking earlier about religion. And he said, so what's ever happened to this concept of sin? And it is a religious, has a religious origin. I believe Jung said, spiritual, it's a spiritual. Is it totally absent in science today, or would an injection of religion help?
Well, in a lot of grant reviews, and there's a lot of there's some structure set up for looking at projects that are being funded and whether they have unethical methods in them. So there's some of that being done right now, and also institutional review boards and within hospitals or within universities have started to review things for their amount of, how ethical they are. And one of the examples that I heard of was, for example, of the physician who was proposing the study was proposing that bone marrow be taken from young children as a control, as part of the experiment. But the people who were reviewing this grant application decided that that wasn't ethical. So it's starting to happen. But I think it's also imperative for us as citizens to say what's not acceptable. And that can be citizens as scientists or citizens as non-scientists. Yes?
Personal thing that cannot be legislated, whereas ethics have canons or laws.
personal. And if science merges the morality into the ethical, then it has an out. It can argue both sides of the fence at the same time. And in the, with the researchers I work, I'm doing this very conveniently. Mm. And in fact, the definitions of morality and ethics have been merged to some extent to facilitate this type of operation. And I see this as a very, very big learning, because we're concerned with two types of ethics as well. We're concerned with the ethics of the research, the clarity of research, and the ethics of the researcher. And the ethics of the researcher are this combined morality and ethics, where morals can be legislated or become societal. The abortion issue is a classic example of it, where a moral issue has been turned into a societal issue and therefore become an ethical one. Should we not, and a good question here, should we not be more clearly defining what a moral issue is and what an ethical issue is before we start getting into the research itself?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And especially with how diverse our culture is with different religious and moral backgrounds. And it certainly points to the need for having a conversation about it so that we can start to decide at what point we will do no harm. If that's maybe the bottom line of what we're trying to achieve, or to do the least harm. Yeah, no reflection.
It sounded almost more like a moral statement than an ethical analysis of it. You know, that they had fun. I'm kind of glad that they at least had fun with it. You know what I'm saying? But it seems like they were ethically on an issue of responsibility, if that's what they're talking about. Sure.
Yeah, that was Oppenheimer's.
His comment?
Yeah. Yeah, and well, Freeman Dyson's analysis of why Oppenheimer thought it was sin. Yeah, I think there was a lot of guilt involved. To a certain extent, we don't know what's going to be the consequence of our action, that we may intend to do good and we don't. But I think if we try to have more of a humbler attitude of humility about it, that we do have the possibility, we're less likely to stride ahead quite so confidently. And be open to conversations from other people that maybe this isn't the right thing to do. It's that self-righteousness that shuts off that conversation and that willingness to realize that you might not be doing the best thing. There's no questioning, no reflection. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
but it, if we don't, I don't know how that we can effectively address the critical questions of today. Because if you look at healthcare, it gets into politics, it gets into science. Any critical question of today involves all sectors of society. And unless we start engaging all of those sectors, we're not going to effectively address those questions. Yes?
I think it's really, I'm very sympathetic to what your book is about and your position, because it reflects a 10-year period of my life to go in the same direction. But I'm still today looking at the problem of, if you address all these problems before you start your work, you know, you're going to be afraid of it. Somebody taught me a big lesson that said, with every little step forward of the horizon, you know, the peripheral vision gets better. So you get the information as you go. And as long as you go carefully, you have a conscience, and then you ask some of these questions and balance it against the possibility that you might be making a step off a big cliff. I think it's legitimate, knowing all the answers. But I think this John Sanford, who's addressed this group, they had a big impact. Seven words out of Greek. I think the first one is agamemnon, not knowing. It's a synonym, not knowing. He told a little story about some hikers that go into the Sierra Nevada and fall out of spring and get caught by a blizzard. Some temperature drops 40 degrees and they freeze to death because they didn't want to prepare for a likelihood. And I think science in the world are placing that dilemma. I mean, they're high tech enough to go into the Sierra now, and they're stupid enough not to know about the spurious or undesirable side effects of that.
Now, that's one of the things that's intrigued me about chaos theory, is that it tells us how fundamentally unpredictable the world really is.
And yet we predict the chaos from those theories.
But we can't know exactly what's going to happen. Yeah.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.